Hello there. Today is Friday, November 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, more allegations of sexual misconduct by a high-profile political figure.
I push his chest away with my hands, and I'm like, if you ever do that to me again.
The latest on the crisis in Zimbabwe. Could gene editing be the future of medicine? Also ahead, an auction this weekend is all about Hollywood icons. It's all on today's International Edition. Democratic U.S. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota is apologizing and requesting an ethics investigation of his own actions after a Los Angeles newscaster Thursday accused him of groping and aggressively kissing her in 2006, 2 years before he was elected to office. Hours earlier, the former TV host and Playboy model Leanne Tweeden had revealed it happened while they were traveling. She was traveling with Franken on a goodwill trip to entertain American troops in the Middle East. Tweeden said she and Franken, then one of America's best-known comedians, were practicing a skit that called for him to kiss her and that he aggressively stuck his tongue in her mouth.
And it all happened so fast. He comes in and, you know, at the last second we're coming in and he puts his hand on the back of my neck and he comes in so fast and he just sort of, you know, it's like that, you know, there was no finesse to it at all, let's put it that way, and he just mashes his mouth to my lips and, you know, it was like wet and he puts his tongue in my mouth and, you know, my reaction, it was just sort of a, you know, I push his chest away with my hands and I'm like, if you ever do that to me again, I was so angry. I was in disbelief, really, and I just sort of, you know, my hand, to this day, I talk about it, and my hand clenches into a fist because I think my initial reaction was that I wanted to hit him. That's what I feel, and I still feel that to this day, I think, and, you know, I just looked at him, I said, don't you ever do that to me again because I won't be so nice about it the next time, and I just walked out, and I just walked out. My mind was reeling, and I'm thinking, you know, I got to find a bathroom. I just wanted to rinse my mouth out. That's all I could think about. I just want to go rinse my mouth out.
Tweeden said later as the entourage was flying back to the U.S., she fell asleep. And during that time, a photo was taken of a smiling Franken grabbing her breasts.
I mean, I saw it. And, you know, knowing how I felt about him, I was angry because in my mind, he was doing that to... That was like his parting gift, right? Like, ha, she's going to see that after we're all gone. And that's like, I gotcha, you know, ha ha. That's going to be the last thing she sees. And, you know, I got the last laugh.
Well, the Senate's Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky called for an ethics investigation of Franken, and the Minnesota senator did concur. Allegations of unwanted sexual advances are also at the center of a special Senate election December 12th in the southern state of Alabama. Multiple women have accused Republican candidate Roy Moore of sexual misconduct decades ago when they were teenagers, and he was a local prosecutor in his 30s. Moore on Thursday continued to deny the charges.
As you know, the Washington Post has brought some scurrilous, false charges, not charges, allegations, which I have emphatically denied time and time again. They're not only untrue, but they have no evidence to support them. Two of the speakers up here said words that I caught. One said unsubstantiated, and another said unproven. Another said they were fake. All of that is true. And the Washington Post is certainly not evidence.
Well, he also rebuffed calls from prominent Republicans to drop out of the race.
This is an effort by Mitch McConnell and his cronies to steal this election from the people of Alabama, and they will not stand for it.
Well, at the daily White House briefing, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was pressed on whether the president thinks Moore should drop out of the race.
The president believes that these allegations are very troubling and should be taken seriously, and he thinks that the people of Alabama should make the decision on who their next senator should be.
So that's a no, he thinks Roy Moore should stay in?
Look, the president said in his statement earlier this week that if the allegations are true, then that Roy Moore should step aside. He still firmly believes that.
Well, in recent weeks, women across the U.S. and some men have publicly disclosed that They've, over the decades, been victims of sexual harassment, most often at the hands of powerful people in their workplace who had control over their career advancement. The barrage of complaints ensued after more than 50 women, most of them Hollywood actors, accused powerful film producer Harvey Weinstein of unwanted sexual advances. The Weinstein effect is increasing awareness about where the line is between friendly banter to more uncomfortable and sometimes criminal motives. VOA's Carolyn Fasuti takes us to a class that teaches how to intervene when witnessing sexual harassment.
The Potter's House is more than just a coffee shop. Along with the Java, they serve up a safe space to chill or to work.
I feel like I want to try that next.
Managers wanted to create more of a sense of community, so they started with the espresso machine.
2 years ago, Potter's House moved it from here against the wall to here, facing outward, so that the baristas could better engage the customers.
Do you want that ice there hot?
Now, with claims about sexual harassment and abuse making headlines, the restaurant industry is looking closer at how customers and waiters interact.
I've seen situations where, like, someone's being sexually harassed, someone's being made to feel uncomfortable, And I don't know. I just have no idea what to do.
So the Potter's House brought in help to train local coffee shop workers.
If they feel like they're going to get away with it and no one's going to call them out.
Melissa Yeo teaches how to intervene and how to de-escalate the situation.
It could be something small and subtle. It could be direct. It's whatever the intervener is comfortable with. But it's to show that there's no one way to step in.
These participants discussed how the service industry, with its natural hierarchy between server and buyer, is a hotbed for discrimination. From generation gaps.
He apologized and said that he's a creature of the 50s and he's from a different time.
To liquor.
The person was intoxicated, came in, started to cause a scene.
To gender attacks.
I hid down on the floor. Behind the counter and cried.
The class placed actions on a spectrum,
I'm just gonna go for it.
Discussing which is more extreme. Then they role-played to better understand sensitivities. The idea is to capture these skills and take them back to their workplace, not only to give their coworkers a hand, but also to stop any abusive behavior directed toward themselves. Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News, Washington.
Well, tensions mounted in Zimbabwe Thursday as Southern African leaders met behind closed doors in Harare and in Botswana's capital to try to defuse the situation following Tuesday's military takeover. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Hopes of a speedy and smooth resolution in Zimbabwe appeared to fade Thursday, as civil society and religious groups urged Robert Mugabe to quickly step down after 37 years in power. But he appeared to resist. And South Africa's president then dashed hopes of a quick final act, telling his parliament that it is too early to take any firm decision now. Mugabe hasn't been seen in public since being placed under house arrest by soldiers Tuesday night. Mediators sent by the South African government met at Mugabe's home Thursday and at State House. Analyst Knox Chitio of the Chatham House think tank, who is Zimbabwean, was in Harare when the military brought out its tanks Tuesday night. He says the longer the military is perceived to be in charge, the more unstable things will become.
The key issue is the time scale. The military will want these negotiations to be completed as quickly as possible. They want to have the president, or if it's acting president, in place as soon as possible. They want an interim administration announced, I think, as soon as possible. The military do not want this to drag out, because the longer all this drags out, the murkier, the messier it could become.
Some key figures in Zimbabwe's opposition are proposing a transitional government ahead of the elections already planned for next year. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai on Thursday urged Mr. Mugabe to resign.
Mr. Robert Mugabe must resign. Step down immediately in line with the national sentiment and expectation. Taking full regard of his legacy and a contribution to Zimbabwe. Pre and post Zimbabwe.
The vice president Mugabe recently fired, arguably the catalyst for this military takeover, has kept a low profile. Emmerson Mnangagwa says Piers Pigou of the International Crisis Group will lose credibility if he appears too close to the military.
It is absolutely critical for the new incumbents to be able to, I suppose, distance themselves as quickly as possible from the illegal actions of the armed forces here, or ostensibly what looks like the... I simply don't know how they're going to put lipstick on that pig.
But Chitio says the negotiators have a lot to discuss. The crisis came out of a long-running, bitter rift in the ruling ZANU-PF party, which Mugabe has led for decades. Observers saw the move to fire Mnangagwa as a step toward the installation of Mugabe's wife, Grace Mugabe, as vice president. That would have put the unpopular first lady next in line, behind her 93-year-old husband.
It's very delicate. There's also negotiations within the party, between the party and the opposition, between the powers that be currently and South Africa. So there's a lot, multiple negotiations, delicate negotiations. Too much talk too soon could do more harm than good, I think is what the military are saying.
The military insists this is not a coup, and the powerful War Veterans Association called the action a bloodless correction. For that narrative to work, they need one thing that no one ever thought would be easy to get: for Zimbabwe's fiery, passionate leader to leave without a fight. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. U.S. lawmakers seek more information from Trump's son-in-law Kushner in the Russia probe. House Republicans clear Keith's first step to sending a tax bill to Trump. A U.S. jury hears closing arguments in a trial of an alleged Benghazi attack organizer. U.S. House Democrats join a growing congressional concern about the State Department. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. It's difficult to overstate the potential that gene editing holds for the future of medicine. As VOA's Kevin Enix tells us, an attempt to explore its potential was undertaken in California this week when a man suffering from a rare genetic disease received an infusion of gene-altering tools that could lead to a cure.
44-year-old Brian Madeau has already beaten the odds. He has lived with Hunter syndrome, a rare genetic disorder, for 44 years and suffered through 26 surgeries.
It seemed like I had a surgery every other year of my life. But it kind of affected me because I was trying to be a professional chef, and it seemed like it kind of hindered my other coworker because I was kind of had to be away a few weeks out of the year.
Now he has agreed to be the test case for a new form of genetic therapy doctors say could change the way some inherited diseases are treated.
Our ultimate goal is to get into children and as young as possible so as they don't suffer any of the consequences of the disease as they get older.
The genetic glitch in the DNA of people with Hunter syndrome means their bodies don't produce a key enzyme that breaks down some carbohydrates. That causes all kinds of complications and usually results in death between the ages of 10 and 20.
Children with Hurler syndrome, untreated, will die before age 10. Children with Hunter syndrome may survive as late as age 15. But both have a very dire progressive clinical course.
The infusion that Madeau is receiving could cure him. Here's how it works. Healthy DNA and two zinc proteins called zinc fingers are loaded into disabled viruses. Once infused into the body, the viruses head to the liver, where doctors hope they will infiltrate damaged liver cells. The fingers will cut open the DNA, insert the new instructions, and fix the troubled genes. That should stimulate the liver to start producing healthy cells and the vital enzyme on its own.
The gene editing is for the liver. Then we use the liver as the factory to make new enzymes.
Doctors will not know for at least a month if the procedure was successful.
This hopefully is the beginning of a large-scale, large effort to be able to cure many of these different inherited diseases.
The team that created the zinc fingers is looking at other genetic diseases, including hemophilia B, that could benefit from this unique medical therapy. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And keeping it on health, next year marks the 100th anniversary of the deadliest flu pandemic in recorded history. More people lost their lives in 1918 in that flu pandemic than World War I. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that although scientists have made headway in controlling a number of diseases, influenza is one that still eludes them.
Each year, scientists make a flu vaccine that's their best guess about what strain of the virus will be circulating the following year. Dr. Anthony Fauci, an infectious disease expert at the National Institutes of Health, says although the vaccine prevents hospitalizations and deaths, it's not ideal.
Even on a good year, the overall efficacy of an influenza vaccine is about 60%. So even though it is always better to get vaccinated against influenza than it is not to get vaccinated, no doubt about that, we need to get a better vaccine.
Several years ago, the vaccine's effectiveness was a dismal 10%. Compare that to the vaccines for measles and yellow fever, which are almost completely effective, and the vaccine for polio, which protects 90% of those who get it. Even manufacturers of flu vaccines are dissatisfied. Dr. David Vaughn is the director of vaccine research and development at pharmaceutical giant GSK.
The disease we're trying to prevent is very prevalent. Up to 20% of us will have an influenza infection during the course of a year.
There's now better treatment for pneumonia and other complications of the flu. But doctors are concerned about another deadly pandemic, like the one in 1918 that claimed 50 million lives worldwide. We asked Dr. Fauci if there could be another deadly pandemic like that one.
Certainly, we've had a flu pandemic in 2009, the H1N1 swine flu, that was not a serious epidemic in the sense of a lot of deaths. It was a pandemic, to be sure, because it was a relatively new virus that was widespread infection throughout the world.
Researchers have found that part of the influenza virus doesn't change from year to year, which may help them produce a vaccine that's more effective. Vaughn says the World Health Organization considers this a high priority.
Most influenza deaths occur in developing countries, and very few vaccinations occur there.
Until a universal influenza vaccine is available, more lives can be saved if more people start getting the imperfect seasonal flu vaccine. Not only can this prevent the spread of the virus, but it lowers the risk of a deadly pandemic, like the one in 1918. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, the Winter Olympics start February 9th, 2018 in South Korea, but Russia's hopes of being there remain in doubt. The World Anti-Doping Agency refused to reinstate the country's suspended anti-doping operation on Thursday. At its meeting in South Korea, WADA President Sir Craig Reedy said Russia's anti-doping agency hasn't met two key requirements for reinstatement.
Technically, they have improved hugely since their compliance was removed in November 2015. But having set a roadmap for compliance, there are two issues which haven't been fulfilled. So We simply can't walk away from the commitments we have in our roadmap. So that's where we are.
WADA said the newly restructured Russian anti-doping agency had made improvements, but they weren't enough to lift a suspension which began 2 years ago. He says that WADA had no rights to prohibit Russia from participating in the Winter Olympic Games and that the agency would continue monitoring for the decision of the International Olympics Committee.
I'm quite certain that the IOC would prefer that RUSADA was declared compliant by the World Anti-Doping Agency. There are, as I said, 2.5 weeks before the IOC have indicated that they want to take a decision. I've indicated that we are likely to be speaking to the investigative commission. So possible for things to change.
Well, the head of Russia's anti-doping agency, Yuri Gana, says his agency has reformed to WADA standards and now completely independent, but the key remaining demands were outside his authority.
We should be very pragmatic about that. We want us to give you any assessments. Well, we have a roadmap. We have two provisions which are not complied with. In that context, well, technically, we've been complying with all we can, all the tasks which could be embraced by an anti-doping agency are being embraced by us. So we are limited in terms of the functionality from the part of the international organization, because we could be more active, but not everyone is willing to cooperate that actively with us. So just to reiterate this, the decision which will be made whether to give the access or not give the access will be made by the Paralympic and Olympic committees. It's their mandate, it's up to them, and we will respect their decision.
Well, the WADA decision could influence the International Olympic Committee, which has the final say on Russia's status for next February's Games. The committee meets next month to discuss investigations into individual Russian doping cases from the Sochi Olympics and into the allegations of state-sponsored manipulation of the anti-doping program. And turning now to our social media segment, we hear from VOA's Andrew Palchevsky.
If there's one story that's dominated social media in the past year, it's Russia's meddling on U.S. social networks, particularly surrounding the 2016 U.S. presidential election. It seems that every week there's a new revelation about just how far the interference went, from the number of ads created, to the amount of money spent, to the number of people who may have been influenced by them. So this week, unsurprisingly, we have yet another story about that interference. But there's one key difference. It's not about Russia's meddling in the U.S., but in the U.K. The Times of London reports that according to a joint research project between the University of California at Berkeley and Swansea University in Wales, there was a spike in Russian-linked activity targeting British social media users in the lead-up to the United Kingdom's 2016 Brexit vote. Britons were reportedly bombarded by more than 45,000 social media posts in the days before the referendum, urging them to vote to leave the European Union. Many of these accounts previously focused on pro-Russia and pro-Vladimir Putin content, before abruptly switching their subject matter to the Brexit referendum. Now, it's because of reports like this that social networks are announcing new plans and procedures to fight misinformation online. Their latest announcement? Facebook, Twitter, Google, and Microsoft are participating in something called the Trust Project. Here's how it works. When content appears in your Facebook newsfeed, Twitter timeline, or your Google or Bing search results, an icon next to the article called a truth indicator will appear. When you click on that truth indicator, information will pop up about the publication, the author of the article, and information about the author's work. The idea is to give news consumers the information to determine whether or not a story is credible. Facebook has already started rolling out these truth indicators on Thursday, and Twitter, Google, and Microsoft say they'll be implementing them soon. Of course, social networks have tried implementing fact-checking, false news alerts, and automated vetting for news in the past, some of which has worked, but much of which hasn't. These new truth indicators are just the latest effort, one that these companies and social media users will surely be watching.
All right. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, if a diamond-encrusted airplane is out of your budget, you might consider, I don't know, something like a rocking chair used by a former president, John F. Kennedy, or stunt performer Evel Knievel's motorcycle jacket. Or maybe you'd prefer a necklace worn by Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind, a glove made for an Apollo astronaut. All of the items and more are on the block when Julian's Auctions holds its annual Hollywood Icons and Idols Friday and Saturday. Martin Nolan is Julian's executive director.
This is such a diverse auction. It's truly fantastic. We have Evel Knievel's jacket. We have motorcycles. We have a rocking chair. We have awards. We have a glove that was made for Neil Armstrong for Apollo 11. We have an Academy Award. We have a Nobel Prize for chemistry. It's truly an amazing auction.
Several dresses and memorabilia of the late Judy Garland make up a big chunk of the auction. Dresses worn in A Star Is Born and Meet Me in St. Louis, the dress Garland wore when she sang Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, also up for sale. On Saturday, the auction is all about jewels of Joseph from Hollywood, one of the earliest high-profile jewelers to the studios. Martin Nolan said Joseph had a special recipe that helped his stunning pieces stand out in classic Hollywood movies.
And Joseph of Hollywood, who made all this amazing jewelry, he had like a secret resin recipe, he called it, that he used at the backing of the stones when he set the stones into the jewelry pieces that allowed the stones to absorb the light rather than bounce back or reflect back at the cameras. And so it made the jewelry really pop on screen.
Well, among the many pieces to be auctioned off will be the jewels worn by Elizabeth Taylor in Cleopatra. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is in the midst of its most severe drug epidemic since the 1980s. Today, more people are dying from drug overdoses than from gun homicides and motor vehicles combined, said President Donald Trump.
Last year, we lost at least 64,000 Americans to overdoses. That's 175 lost American lives per day. That's 7 lost lives per hour in our country. Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of unintentional death in the United States by far.
Ending the epidemic will require mobilization of government, local communities, and private organizations. It will require the resolve of our entire country, said President Trump. The U.S. Department of State plays a key role in this effort. That's because the crisis is fueled by heroin and synthetic opioids that were produced overseas, while transnational criminal organizations move this deadly product into the United States. For these reasons, the national strategy to respond to this crisis must include an international component, said Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Jim Walsh. Already we are seeing some successes. At the request of the United States, the United Nations recently placed 2 chemicals used to make the drug, fentanyl, on an international list of controlled substances. Since 2015, due in part to U.S. requests, China has taken unprecedented action, controlling 138 narcotic substances. The State Department is also using foreign assistance to strengthen Mexico's capacity to interdict illegal drugs. This helps improve security along our shared border against the cross-border distribution of heroin and synthetic drugs. These efforts, along with a slew of new tools developed by the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Bureau, which address addiction and demand for drugs, will also help address the opioid crisis domestically, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Walsh.
With over 64,000 Americans dead from overdoses since 2016, with drug traffickers taking advantage of new ways to move and sell their product, including through the dark web, and rogue chemists developing insidious new synthetic drugs at an alarming rate, We must constantly be adapting our approach and responding to new and deadly realities.
This challenge is a dire one, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Walsh, and it will continue to be a top priority for the department.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.